We're zeroing in on lawn and turf care here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, John Steyer. John, UW Extension lawn and turf research expert. He works out of the Department of Horticulture and the College of Ag and Life Sciences. Comes by every so often to talk with us about what's going on with your lawn and mine. And mine's a mess, but maybe I could ask John a few questions about my lawn, but certainly you get the priority. So if you have a question, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. John Steyer, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Nice to be back.
How's your lawn look?
It's looking better than it did a month ago. I had a lot of winter kill on my lawn.
I did too.
Lost a lot of the ryegrass, so I reseeded those areas with nothing other than ryegrass, because it comes up quick.
Well, I tell you, I threw down some seed, and the birds, you know, were actually walking right behind me. I'm pretty much picking up what I was putting down, but I imagine it'll come. You know, I had to reseed, or I sodded an area of the lawn last year, and it turns out it's Kentucky bluegrass, but it's a must be a little different strain, so the colors are.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a bicolored lawn. Well, probably tricolored when you factor in the Creeping Charlie.
Yeah, I've had some calls on that already this year, Larry, where people have sodded an area, and the sod that they brought in is much darker than what was there before.
Right.
And a lot of times it's because they may not have enough nitrogen on their lawn to darken it, and that will blend out over time to some degree. The other thing is that the sod growers are always using newer varieties. The newer varieties tend to be darker green than the older varieties. So sometimes we have to live with it.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, Rich in Sauk County is already online waiting to talk with you. So let's go to Rich. Hi, Rich.
Hi there. Thank you. We live in a wooded area out in, well, it's right on the edge of town, but anyhow, have a lot of shade and a lot of wooded, and you know, I threw grass in, you know, grass seed and so on and so forth, and got it going. However, there's a grass that is invading, mainly in the areas where I couldn't get bluegrass or the other grasses, you know, the regular seed mixtures to grow, even the shady stuff, very difficult time. And this grass is a very shallow root system. The very fine grass, and it is almost like a lime green. I mean, it's not dark green at all. It's almost like a lime green. Do you know what that would be?
Well,
and it invaded some from out of the woods.
Yeah, there's lots of different grasses. There are over 2,000 species of grasses. If this is coming out of the woods, it's not likely to be a turf grass. My suggestion would be to take it in your county extension office and see if they can identify it for you.
Okay. Yeah, you need to. Do you want to get rid of it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't look like your normal bluegrass, but at least I have grass now where before it was very sparse. So
you might want to hang on to it.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to find out what it is, take a sample into your county office and they'll help you out.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Katie in Green Bay's up next. Hi, Katie. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have two questions. I just want to make sure I'm doing the right thing. In the past, we've put Milorganite on twice a year, and I'm wondering if we should do that three times a year. We've already put one on, and I believe we actually did it too early. But nonetheless, I think the second one is like 4th of July and then Labor Day. That's my question number one. And number two, I'm constantly, I'm not using herbicides, so I'm trying to pull out the clover out of my yard, and I know there's two kinds of clover. Correct me if I'm wrong. If it has a yellow flower, it's more the Japanese.
Well,
and that's bad.
Well, there's many types of clover, actually, and if it's got a yellow flower, it might actually be something else altogether. It might be bird's foot trefoil that you've got in there.
No, I know what bird's foot trefoil looks like.
I've not seen Japanese clover in a lawn before, but there's lots of things that pop up that I don't necessarily see in lawns. I'm used to mostly seeing white clover in lawns. The clover is generally a sign of insufficient nitrogen in the soil. Nitrogen is usually the limiting nutrient for growing grass. So two applications, Milorganite, if you bump that up to three or even four applications, depending on how much you put on at one time, that will help reduce the amount of clover, most likely in the lawn, because there will be more nitrogen for the grass to grow. Milorganite's kind of foolproof in terms of when you put it down. It's a slow-release product. The nitrogen is only released by microbial activity, bacteria and fungi in the soil as they degrade the Milorganite. They really require warm temperatures and moist soils to do so. So if you put it down when the soil is cold and wet, not a lot of the nitrogen is going to get released anyways. So you wouldn't have to worry about quote unquote losing the nitrogen too much from that standpoint. You could also, if you wanted to put it down a fourth time, put it down in autumn.
Autumn?
Probably around October 30th or so.
Okay.
Halloween.
Maybe even a little bit earlier than that, since
okay,
it's Milorganite.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Katie, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. So get in touch. Jane in Madison, you are next. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have a question about grass. I have a mixture of some grass that goes, it's very short and starts seeding, and then some that's longer that doesn't start seeding until it's really tall. And which one is the fescue? Are they the shorter grasses?
Well, they might be the shorter grasses. I'm not sure what you'd have in your mix, but the perennial grasses that we use tend to seed sometime, depending on the species, between about mid-May and mid-June.
Okay.
And some of the grasses, they prefer to seed at taller heights, but some of the grasses, as we keep mowing them, will still be able to form seed heads, even at the lower heights. They just won't form as many of them. But come July, all the seed heads will be gone.
Does it matter if the seed heads are there? Does that, like, weaken the grass?
Well, it does to a little bit of extent, because every stalk that has a seed head on it, that stalk will die.
Okay.
And all the roots and everything associated with that stalk will die.
Oh.
But this is natural. And so most of our grasses that we grow for turf will have multiple shoots and multiple stalks, and they're not all seeding at the same time. And the ones that aren't seeding this year will seed next year. And so, by and large, your lawn won't suffer from it.
Is it a bad time to put grass seed into patches that had winter kill?
It is actually probably later than I would recommend, although you could still do it. And if the weather continues like it has been so far this spring, where it's cool and wet, it will be no problem. Normally, we don't like to seed this late in the spring, because it's starting to get hot, and the heat will actually inhibit or even kill the grass seedlings. But we've had cool, wet summers before in Wisconsin, and if this is another one of those, you might as well put it in, because if you don't put anything in, you'll probably get weeds growing there.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Great. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Jane. Jim and Stevens Point, we're on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Hello, gentlemen. I had two quick things. One is, I'd like it if the professor could recommend some books that are kind of geared towards lay people in terms of home turf management that aren't overly technical. I'm familiar with the Melinda Myers book, and I think that's useful, and I wonder if you had any other recommendations. And the second thing I wanted to ask about is the use of chemical supplements to the lawn. I hear a lot of people talking about environmental concerns of the supplements that they use, that those are going into groundwater, that they might hurt plants and other ecosystems and animals. And it seems like there's a lot of kind of confusion about that. I think it's important to care for the environment, but I think some of these chemicals can be used in a way, probably. I think the professor would argue that if they're used intelligently, they don't do a lot of harm to groundwater and streams and things.
Okay.
For example, one person was talking about using Milorganite, and probably out of a concern for the environment, since the caller talked about not using herbicides. But then you were saying that the Milorganite is slow-released, and maybe the nitrogen and the melorganite that she's using is really, you know, being released in streams and that kind of thing, and it would be better to use a man-made fertilizer rather than something that's organic in that case. So I wonder if you can talk about how to use maybe herbicides and fertilizers in ways that help your lawn but don't hurt the environment, or how to educate yourself about that.
Okay. Well, good questions.
Yeah, you asked a couple great questions. Another book to look for at the bookstores, it's called Picture Perfect. It's written by David Meller, who used to be the assistant groundskeeper at for the Milwaukee Brewers, and he's now moved on, and he's a head guy out at Boston at Fenway Park. But he also has written it from a layperson's perspective, and there's an emphasis in part of the book about actually mowing your lawn and striping it to make it look like the major leagues, which is pretty neat, and he has some patterns and things in that. In terms,
what's his name again? Just
David Meller, M as in Michael, E-L-L-O-R.
Okay, David Meller, all right.
David Meller.
All right.
Very prominent in the world of sports turf management nationally.
Yeah, he got his degree here, didn't he? Did he get his degrees here? Or
actually, we got our degrees together at a university outside of this state. it was kind of funny. We both got our degrees together there, and then we ran into each other about 10 years later here in Wisconsin. But great guy. Yeah, your other question, we could spend hours, if not days, on this, and I do spend an awful lot of time traveling around the state and around the country, and even internationally. I was in Italy 2 weeks ago talking about some of this stuff, about turf, the environment, and chemicals in the environment, and so forth. And the long and short of it is, the poison is in the dose. And to give you an example, there has been what are deemed extravagant amounts of nitrogen leaching from underneath prairie systems that are dominated by legumes in Europe, in some cases, where the nitrogen rates are higher than what we would want to see in our groundwater here. So it really depends on the amount and how they're used. And I think it's just such an open-ended question that, Larry, I'm going to leave it there for now. Mm-hmm. And other callers can help hone it in. Otherwise, you want to come down sometime and see me, I'll be glad to chat with you, because you raise a lot of good questions. We also have a number of fact sheets out there at the UW Extension website that might be helpful as well.
Yeah, I'd go to that. Go to the UW Extension publications, and there's quite a few on lawn care that are pretty good.
That's right.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. Angela in Parterville, we will go to you next. Hi, Angela.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question, and I know that one of the previous callers was talking about white clover, and I would like to encourage that growth instead of normal grass in my yard. I'd like that as a ground cover. And just wondering, do I just do nothing and let it grow, or should I supplant that with some seeds, or what should I do?
That's a good question. We've had several studies as part of a Midwest regional project over the last 10, 15 years on low-input sustainable turf. One of those projects several years ago, we mixed different types of clover in with different grasses, tall fescue, fine fescues, Kentucky bluegrass, so on and so forth. And we inoculated the clover seeds with the rhizobium bacteria so that they could develop nodules and fix nitrogen from the atmosphere and so forth. And I'll have to tell you, I was really surprised that in almost all of the plots, the clover did not do very well. It just seems to come in better naturally as nitrogen becomes deficient in the soil. And so if you want clover to come in, the easiest thing is to do nothing. Don't fertilize your lawn. Clover will come in. You'll probably get other weeds coming in as well, but that's a great way to get clover. When we do clover ecology and control studies at our research site, we don't fertilize those areas.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. John Steyer, UW Extension Lawn and Turf Research Expert in the Department of Horticulture, our guest today on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking lawn and turf on this edition of Garden Talk with John Steyer, Larry Mueller here. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890 and email us at talk@wpr.org. Alan in Fitchburg's up next. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Say, I got a problem. I've got a little oak woods, and I've been three times I've herbicided it with it's got stinging nettles and a whole bunch of stuff and longer grasses and stuff, and it's still coming up. What I would like to plant something in there, you know, that would be low maintenance and lower than the natural grasses in there. How the heck can I get it in there?
All right. Now, are the nettles coming back? What is coming back?
The nettles and all kinds of weeds. I've poisoned it three times last year, and now everything's starting to come right back up again because of the seed bank in there. What can I put in there that would be a low? You know, I was thinking maybe ferrous grasses, but I got too much weed competition in there to even start that. Well, how can I handle that?
Well, I think we have to look at this what I would deem holistically. What is the ultimate ecology of the site here? If you've got oak trees planted there, grasses by and large don't do very well in shade, and so I think you're always going to struggle having any grass of any reliable cover in there short outside of a few sparse tufts here and there, which means other things are going to come up. And in terms of, you use the word poisoning, which indicates to me that I'm not sure if even the necessarily right approach or even herbicide is being taken here, because different weeds, if we're going to use an herbicide to control those weeds, different weeds can require different herbicides to be used. So you really need to know what weeds are there. The other option maybe to go here is to mulch the area in with wood chips every couple of years or so and help keep the weeds down that way.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Julie in Eau Claire is up next. Let's go there. Hi, Julie. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
I think it's kind of probably a dumb question, but I'll give it a shot. We recently took a seasonal campsite, and it was a open field before, and it's all dug up, and basically we have lots of sand, dandelions, and some grass growing. And we're only there every other weekend, so we can't water or anything. Any ideas of what we could do for ground cover?
Yeah, not a dumb question at all. This is a very good question. Where in the Wisconsin is the site?
It's in Holcomb.
It's in Holcomb. And Larry, my geography's a little stale today. Can you help me out?
Chippewa area.
Chippewa area. Okay. If you were down further south, I'd say probably a tall fescue would be a nice way to go because it's going to develop a very deep root system, about 18 inches deep, and do very well in the sand, and it's very tough. And once it gets established, it will be able to take that biweekly traffic pretty well. You could still plant it there, and you might get lucky. It might winter kill on you if ice ever develops.
Okay.
But you could certainly try some tall fescue. Probably to hedge my bets, I'd mix some fine fescue in there too. Some creeping red fescues, some chewings fescues, some hard fescues. It'll look ugly. They don't mix very well as a lawn, but really all you want is something to hold the soil down and something to camp on. So when you pitch your tent or lay on the ground, you've got some nice vegetation there that can withstand the traffic.
That?
Tall fescue, just like it sounds. And
F-E-S-C-U-E.
F-E-S-C-U-E. Gotcha.
Okay.
And that doesn't need a lot of watering then?
No. It'll need to get some water to get it established, so you're probably best off putting it down late summer, maybe late August or so, and count on some September rains to get it going for you.
Well, the way this summer's going, it rains every other day. So
that's true. I mean, we got rain forecast for the next week here, so
so just throw some seed down and hope for the best.
Yeah, scratch the seed in the soil with a rake. If you want some more guidance, there's a bulletin on lawn establishment that you can get off the UW Extension website.
Oh, great! Mm-hmm. And then just a real quick question: you mentioned creeping Charlie. Any cures for that?
Well, you can. There's several. You can pull it out with your hands, which is very difficult to get all the stems out, and so it It generally needs to be redone every couple months. There's herbicides that can be used. Broadleaf herbicides are best used in the fall and then again in the spring when it's in bloom. Usually one at fall application followed by the application the next spring will do it well enough. Third option is to learn to love it.
Yeah. Okay, we could do that because we have a little grass with our Creeping Charlie.
Yeah, that's about sounds like my lawn, or at least part of it.
And, you know, normally the Creeping Charlie, even if it's controlled with herbicides, is going to come back unless the grass is maintained very dense.
Well, it is kind of, they're cute little flowers, so
yeah,
maybe we'll just live with them.
That's right.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Julie, for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah, I'm about giving up on creeping, controlling it, because I had it on two occasions totally eliminated from my lawn, and it didn't take long for it to start coming back.
Yeah, we lost a couple large trees in the woods next to my house, and Creeping Charlie has come up in those areas, and this year it's starting to invade the lawn.
Peter in Brookfield, we turn to you. Hi, Peter.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got one of those I wonder why questions.
Okay.
I wonder why when you put in a flower bed or plant a tree and clear the grass wants to grow back in there, it seems like, overnight. But yet if you have a bare spot appear in your lawn naturally, the grass never wants to grow back into it.
It is very simple. It's called Murphy's Law.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy.
I understand. I feel your pain.
I've got a couple of spots just like that in my lawn.
It is amazing.
I have no idea.
Okay, it was just one of those rhetorical kind of a question.
Yep.
You know, it just does seem that that's the way it is, though, because I've got, it seems like, spots in my lawn that have been bare for years, and nary a blade of grass will grow in it, but put in a flower bed or plant a tree, and boy, oh boy, that's all you're doing is trying to get the grass out of that area.
Yeah. Well, part of it may just simply be the soil disturbance. The grass that we use as lawns tend to be what are called either primary or secondary colonizers, not tertiary colonizers. And so different grass species do really well in freshly disturbed soil. So that may be part of it.
Yeah, I've even tried that when a dead spot is and try and dig it up and turn it over and all of that, and it's still nothing wants to grow in that area.
Well, it's a mystery on my lawn, too. I got a couple spots just like that, Peter. So I'm not sure what to tell you, but thanks for calling. Maybe somebody else got an idea too. But I think you had your response. It could be it's too shady. It could be
There's a zillion things. You know, I've had some spots in my lawn before, and when I've dug them up, I found out, when they built the home, they dumped a bunch of sand there, and so it doesn't hold water. So that's why the grass never grows there. A couple other times, I found a big rock.
Yeah.
2 inches below the soil. Another time, there's a tree stump under there. So there's all kinds of stuff buried there that we don't know is there.
On to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Good morning, Larry and guests. I've got kind of a basic question on how to make your lawn thicker. Through years of fertilizing on schedule and taking care of the weeds, it still is rather thin. It's healthy, but thin, and I do have poor soil in the Milwaukee area, a lot of clay in it. Would there be anything wrong with me, say, core aeration a couple times a year, maybe spring and fall, and maybe applying a thin layer of topsoil over the existing lawn and hopefully getting a nice, thicker, healthier soil?
Well, those are certainly good options. The core aeration will provide some space in that clay soil for the roots to grow and help get some more oxygen down to the roots. And generally speaking, we usually see the turf respond positively to a core aeration. If you put down some topsoil, over time you can build up a layer of maybe better soil. I would certainly at least start with the core aeration, and then you can decide whether or not you want to get into adding the top dressing soil. One of the problems that we oftentimes see with adding soil like that to home lawns is you'll import weed seeds. So that's not always a great thing to do. Golf courses will top dress with straight sand in order to avoid that problem and keep the putting green smooth. The other thing you can do is maybe plant a more a different species of grass here. If you've got Kentucky bluegrass, that really likes oxygen and well-aerated soil that you're not going to find in the clay. So sometimes the fine fescues will do a little bit better in that regard, or even the perennial ryegrass. Both
Great.
Of those tend to have a more robust root system in poor soil situations.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, John, for calling. Appreciate it. And let's see. Don, I think, in Rice Lake is up next. Don, hello.
Are you there?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. First, I'd like to make a comment that I'm a member of Public Radio, and I would just like to mention to anybody out there listening that if you're a member, you've already gotten your money back on information from this program.
Thank you.
You bet. I have a big problem with dandelions. We have a huge lawn. I've always had a problem, but last year after the summer we had, in areas they have taken over totally, to where I have no grass left. It's all dandelions, and I'm wondering the best way to attack this.
Well, you know, you really put me on the spot now after what you said about getting your money back.
No, I won't hold you to that.
I think we have to take a look, and I don't know your situation there specifically, but we have to take a look at what the soil's like and what the grass that we're trying to grow there is like, and what the mowing habits have been, and what the irrigation abilities are, and what the fertility has been. Dandelions are weeds that we oftentimes come into lawns when, again, they're not being properly fertilized or mowed, although they can come in even when everything's being done right. And certainly if we have a bad summer that kills a lot of the grass, that's a great opportunity for weeds to come in.
Well, we have pretty good topsoil here, and my mowing habits are I mow in a different direction each time.
Yeah.
I mow, and
how high do you mow?
Usually 2.5 to 3 inches.
All right, so you're good there. You fertilize probably 2, 3, 4 times a year?
I have not been fertilizing because mainly because of the dandelions. I didn't know if I should be fertilizing and making them grow more, or if some of this weed and feed works.
Fertilizer will make a lot more difference to the grass than the dandelions. As you're finding out, dandelions can grow very well without any fertilizer at all. So adding some fertilizer, they really don't need much nitrogen anyways, and so they don't use the extra nitrogen that you put down. Grasses need the nitrogen.
Okay.
So the grass will benefit much more from the nitrogen than the dandelions will.
Is there a fertilizer you recommend?
There are many, many different fertilizers.
Okay.
In most cases, depending on the soil type and so forth, in most cases for most home lawn situations, because we don't have the traffic that we do on sports fields or golf courses and things like that, I would recommend something that is about 50 to 60% slow-release fertilizer and the rest water-soluble fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of a very blanket statement. There are minute differences that we would get into depending on the time of year that you're fertilizing and so forth. But most of the fertilizers that you're going to find at the retail level already are the proper mixture of slow and fast release fertilizers.
Okay. All right.
You want something with high nitrogen. Based on a soil test, you may not need any phosphorus at all. If you're not sure, you could probably go phosphorus free unless you're in a sandy soil situation. And then some potassium. So the three numbers on the bag in order are always nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium.
Mm-hmm. And how many times a year do you think I should fertilize?
3 to 4 in most cases.
Okay.
Again, it will depend on the rate. If you only put down a low rate, then in some cases we'll see people fertilize 6, 7, 8 times a year if they're only putting down a quarter rate or so at a time. But generally, if you follow the rate that's on the bag, you're looking at probably 3 to 4 times a year.
Okay.
All right.
Well, that'll help me. Thank you.
Yeah,
you're
thanks.
Welcome.
Thanks, Don, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And let's see here. Well, we'll go from Rice Lake to Milwaukee. Let's talk to Aaron next. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I've got a small lot, probably 700 to 800 square feet in Milwaukee. And over the last 3 summers, I've been in school as well as working full time, so it's been neglected. So it really looks terrible. What's not bare spots is really bumpy and filled with dandelions and probably creeping Charlie, what have you. I'm considering starting from scratch and reseeding the whole thing, digging it out. I'm wondering, first of all, if that's a good idea. And then if it is, what kind of mix I should have considering my situation, which is mostly shade, and I have a large dog and a 7-year-old who really tear it up, so I need something that's tough and shade tolerant if I do that.
Well, I can help you on at least two of those three situations. So the dog situation, if the dog used to digging holes in the yard, I'm sorry, there's just no grass that's going to stand up to that.
Right, he doesn't
plant,
dig, he
just
runs around.
Yeah. Otherwise, in the shade, is it pretty well drained?
I believe it is, yeah.
If you don't get ice forming on it, and you're in Milwaukee and you don't get ice forming on the ground and you're in the shade and you want something tough, I would go with tall fescue.
Tall fescue, okay.
I would get a turf-type tall fescue. Now, realize there are tall fescues that are sold for pasture, and there are tall fescues sold for turf. You want the more expensive seed. You're going to spend, you know, instead of 60 cents a pound, you'll spend $1.20 or $2 a pound. Not a big deal. You want to seed it at about 8 to 9 pounds per 1,000 square feet.
Okay.
And that should do you.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds great. And then I'm wondering what I should do to prepare ahead of time. Can I start a compost and add that down with some Milorganite?
Well, you could. You may not need any compost. Tall fescue does pretty good over a wide range of soil types from clay to sand.
Okay.
You will need to get rid of the existing plants that are there.
Right.
And if the ground is bumpy now, you want to have time to work the ground and smooth it out.
Right.
Because if it's bumpy when you plant, it will always be bumpy.
Right.
So you probably want to kill the vegetation that's there with a non-selective herbicide like Roundup this summer.
Okay.
And let it die, and then probably beginning of August, you want to till it up. And then let it sit for a week or two, and then till it up again, and then rake it smooth, and remove any stones or anything larger than a peach pit.
Okay.
And then seed into that late August.
Oh, seed it in late August.
Seed it in late August.
Okay.
Get some water on it. It'll germinate in about 7 to 10 days.
Okay.
And you should be in good shape from there.
Oh, that sounds great. I was thinking I'd have to wait until next spring.
No,
I would. You'll have a much better lawn if you seed it late August than you will if you wait till next spring.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Aaron. Appreciate your call. Margaret in Waterloo is next. Hi, Margaret.
Hi there. You answered a lot of my questions with this last caller. I'm so happy. I feverishly took notes. So that's wonderful. My particular situation is that this patch of ground that's been neglected is over an old cobblestone driveway. So I'm thinking kind of shallow grass, rooting grass, but I have no idea. What would you recommend in this situation?
Do you have any idea how deep the soil is over the cobblestones, what type of soil it is?
I don't. It's in Waterloo, digging in the flower beds. I've come across a lot of clay. So I would imagine there's clay involved in this soil. I think in some parts we can see the bricks.
Okay.
So it's not very deep.
Okay.
An inch or two maybe.
So you're going to need something that's very drought tolerant and doesn't need much water, doesn't use much water. Tall fescue uses a lot of water. We don't need to irrigate it very much. I bring this up because I told the other caller to use tall fescue. We don't
yeah.
need to irrigate it very much, but it does use a lot of water. It sucks
okay.
the water out of the soil.
Okay.
In your case, there's not much soil there, so we need something that does not use much water. The
okay.
trade-off for not using much water is it's going to grow slowly, but that means you don't have to mow it as much. So I would use a mixture of fine fescues here.
Okay. Great. And I can follow the seeding, the tilling up plan that you just outlined for him?
Exactly. Although
Excellent.
You'll have to be very careful if the soil's that shallow with your rototiller.
Yeah, yes. Yes, okay, well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Good luck with you.
Thanks, Margaret. Jack in Harvard, Illinois. Your turn now. Hi, Jack.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking the call. I have a large area with a lot of oak trees, really, really large oak trees, and my primary concern is to do what's best for them. In that regard, I have a lot of mulch, huge mulch beds around the oak trees. Then there's the grass, or what used to be grass, but it's mostly dandelions and stuff like that now. So I could weed and feed and that sort of thing. I just wondered if there's anything if I should be mindful about with regard to the oak trees. One person suggested if I tried to make a nice turf lawn, that would not be good for the trees, and it'd be better just let it go to weeds, I guess.
Well, I don't know about the trees being hurt by the lawn per se, at least directly, if these are already large oak trees. If they're already large oak trees, they're going to outcompete the grass, hands down. The damage to the oak trees would come in if people with mowers weren't careful and they nicked the bark off the oak trees and introduced damage there, which led to disease and so forth. My recommendation in this case, since you've got large mature oak trees, is don't plant any grass underneath the drip line of the oak trees.
Okay.
And just keep mulch to a minimum underneath the oak trees. My arborist friends tell me that what they're seeing a lot of is people will plant the mulch too deeply around the trees, which leads to root rot diseases and things like that. I'm talking here when you see the mulch 6, 12, 18 inches thick around the trees. My friends are telling me that's too much that work with trees. So
3 to 4 inches, maybe?
3 to 4 inches, Larry, I think would be plenty. Even 1 to 2 is going to help keep the weeds down if you don't want any weeds under there. But the oaks provide so much shade anyways, it's just not any account to try to even grow grass underneath the drip line.
Well, that's what you'd have to mulch all the way out to the extent of the drip line then, right? Otherwise, what are you going to have there?
That's correct, unless you plant a low-growing ground cover that likes a shade like Boston Ivy or something.
Okay.
There's a bulletin called Growing Grass in the Shade that you can get off the UW Extension website, and on the back of that, there's a large list of potential low-growing ground covers that could work in that area.
And that's called Growing Grass in the Shade, you said?
It's called Growing Grass in Shade.
Okay.
And it's at the end of it, under the section where all else fails.
All right, on that note, I'll say goodbye.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jack. Thank you very much for calling. John Steyer, UW Extension horticulturist, our guest here. He's a lawn and turf guy. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking lawn and turf care with John Steyer, UW Extension horticulturist. Thanks for listening in, by the way. Really appreciate your participation in the program. Give us a call if you'd like to join in, 800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And Jeannie in West Bend is up next. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have a small lawn. It's a waterfront lawn. The grass is real thin, and we put down grass seed and a little bit of topsoil. It gets a lot of traffic, but the grass, it grows up real delicate, like very delicate blades of grass. And then, of course, people walk on it, and it gets very stomped down. I know we've had a lot of rain, but even in the driest summer, the lawn never really dries out completely. It never gets, brittle grass.
Right.
How do you do core aeration? Is that what we have two? Also, we have two large catalpa trees, and they've got some pretty big roots, so maybe that's affecting it.
That could be. So I hear you saying that the grass is always kind of sparse and spindly, and the soil's wet, but you have two large catalpa trees. So is the soil always wet where the grass is not doing very well, or does it dry out?
Well, it'll eventually dry out if we stop getting rain and have a drought.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Now, our neighbors on the other side, they must put a lot of fertilizer on or something, because they have a pretty... Their lawn gets mushy, I know, but it's real
lush.
Thick.
Yeah.
But we don't really put any fertilizer on. I'm a little concerned with, being on the water. I don't want to contaminate that. So.
Yep. So, do you have a slope down to the water?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, it's flat. I mean, yeah, it's flat where the lawn is, but there's a huge slope.
Okay, so, but the lawn area is flat.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's really small.
Okay.
But right before it is a huge slope, yes.
Okay. So if you don't fertilize the slope, you can feel pretty good about putting some fertilizer down as long as you don't overdo it. And the standard recommendation is about a pound of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet. If you want to be extra careful, you can go at half a rate.
Okay.
And that will help the grass out quite a bit.
Now, you understood about the slope. The slope is before the lawn,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The slope
is between the lawn and the water, right?
No.
Oh.
It goes slope, lawn, water.
Oh, okay. So the lawn's flat and the lawn leads right to the water then.
Right.
Okay. So you can still fertilize the lawn, but don't fertilize the water. In other words, use a drop spreader and probably stay back, since it's flat and there's no slope, as long as you stay back about 10 feet, you should be good.
Okay, that would be half the lawn, probably.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the best that you're ever going to be able to do.
Okay.
You know, when I think about natural Wisconsin, we didn't have fertilized lawns right up to the lakes. And we had large, tall plants right up to the lakes. And they served as kind of a buffer.
Right.
And that may be the best way to protect the lakes, is to have a buffer strip around all the lakes. But, of course, I know everybody who has a lake home wants to be able to see the lake. So we've got ourselves into a conundrum here.
But the aeration, you don't think that would help?
No, I don't think so. It sounds like a fertility problem to me.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Well, what if you put in some tall grasses or with sedges? We've got an author coming up to talk about sedges.
Yeah, there could. And maybe Andrew, when he comes in to talk about sedges, he can address this a little bit. The other thing that the caller could do, Larry, is put in a grass that doesn't require much nitrogen. And again, in this case, that would probably be the fine fescues. They're not real traffic tolerant, so depending on how much use the lawn area gets, it may not work out real well for them either.
All right, let's go to Dave in Menominee Falls. Dave, hi to you.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for calling.
I've got a lot of new construction 10 years ago. Before that, it was a cow pasture. At the east side of my lot is a tree line where the last subdivision was. And the developer raked off a lot of topsoil, created a fairly steep, short incline. All the neighbors to the north, their lawns lean towards mine. I've got this slope at the back of the lot, or the back of the lot line to the east, that slopes down. Obviously, where those two slopes meet, I've got a lot of water. By this time, it pretty much dries up. But until then, a river runs through it. And I'm wondering what I've done to help mitigate this to a degree was to dig a trench down about 2 feet, fill it with gravel, and then create like a dry well. But I still get a lot of water running all the way across the back of the lot. It's not so bad if you're not going to walk on it or let the dogs go there, but it's a problem. And then on top of that, I've got invasive, a lot of thistles. And my professionals are saying, well, it's because you got this slope that faces west. I don't know why that would have anything to do with it, but I was wondering if either of these can be addressed.
Are these Canada thistles?
Huge. They're huge. They grow up. If I let them go, they'll go 2, 3, 4 feet tall.
Yeah. Yeah. So that could be Canada thistle. But are you mowing this area?
Yes.
Okay. So
when it's not soggy. I mean,
yeah,
there have been times when I was taking my lawn tractor out, because I've got about an acre lot.
Okay.
And
yeah,
if I go out on my lawn tractor, I'll send up a wake.
Yeah,
behind the lawn tractor.
We're talking a hydrology and engineering situation here, which goes far beyond your personal space, unfortunately. And we're seeing more and more of this as we build subdivisions in floodplains and things like that, unfortunately. And so this really is a bigger issue. You know, you can dig a dry well. on your property, but eventually the drywall fills up with water too, and then it still has to percolate, and then it takes time to percolate down through the underlying soil structure underneath the drywall. And, you know, unfortunately, that's just the way it is.
Okay.
Unless you buy your neighbors out and regrade the land.
I mean, when they dug the foundation for the house, I walked into the hole, and it was solid clay down 8-9 feet.
Yeah,
so
I've got a guy in my neighborhood. He built his house. His house was built in an outlot, and then the unscrupulous developer sold it to him without telling that it was the lowest point in the whole neighborhood and was not intended to be built on. He's got a sump pump out in his yard every single day of the year. I call him Mr. Pump.
Oh man.
So, you know, unfortunately, it's just we all have to be, I think, sensitive to the fact that we've got hydrology issues at work here, and sometimes developers are not necessarily doing us the best of favors when they
sure.
build these slopes.
What about the thistles?
What about the thistles? The thistles, mowing will help keep them down and prevent them from getting worse. But if these are Canada thistles, they spread by underground creeping rootstocks, which can be several feet deep in the soil and several feet long in the soil. And it's very, 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 very difficult to eliminate those. The only way to really eliminate those is with the use of a broadleaf herbicide. Several applications, applying the herbicide every time the weeds come up. For probably a year, 2, 3, 4, 5 year period, until those creeping root stocks have their energy reserves exhausted.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you very much.
But don't apply the herbicide when there's water. When there's standing water, don't apply the herbicide when there's standing water.
Okay, because it won't take it up.
Well, because it won't take it up, and you don't want to get the herbicide in the water. There are some herbicides that are okay to get in the water. There are other herbicides that aren't okay. And without showing you exactly what herbicide to use on that site, the safest thing is just don't put it when there's standing water out there.
All right. Good luck, Dave. Thanks. Fran in Milwaukee's up next. Hi, Fran.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Sure.
I have a lawn out front, the boulevard. I am looking, the city, when they dug around and did new streets, packed clay way down, tamped it, it's like hard, hard clay, little teeny bit of sod, and this was years ago, and it's just, it's a very poor quality kind of situation, but there's a section that has been planted by my husband in native Wisconsin prairie, and that's flourishing. Well, partly we use, you know, really good compost out there. So something is growing in that hard clay. But what I want with my lawn around that little prairie section, I don't want to dig it up. I have some grass. I have some clover. I want to hold on to that. I just did a really thorough digging up of all the dandelions, but I didn't dig out the roots. I just took a knife and cut the dandelions off below the ground line and pulled the dandelions. So what I'm looking for is maybe something that I would spray over the area that would maybe kill the dandelions and then but would not damage the grass or the clover. And then what I'm looking to do is spread grass seeds. Because all of that area has been, you know, there are little holes where I dug the dandelions out, and that would probably be a good way to start grass seeds. So I'm thinking to spread, just sort of cast grass seeds, and then sort of sprinkle the compost over the top of that. And I'm wondering what all that sounds like to you, and I'm wondering what grass seeds I should use. And I'm wondering if you can tell me about some kind of chemical that's non-harmful.
Well, I sure admire your thoughtfulness and all of your efforts in this. Since, though, the entire dandelion roots were not removed, those dandelions will come back no matter what you do. And what we find is that when we do exactly what you did, we tend to split that dandelion root, and then we get two or more dandelions coming up in that spot instead of just one.
Okay.
So we really need, if we're going to dig dandelions out, we really need to dig them out so that we get the entire root.
Okay.
So I guess at this point, you got to wait until they come up, and then you can go out and dig them out. There is no herbicide that I can tell you will control the dandelions that will all not also injure or control the clover. That's just the way it is.
How about if I, if there's an herbicide that's non-harmful that I spread that I and that it does the dandelions in and also the clover, but then cast clover seeds?
Well, you could, but the clover seeds that you cast, unless you get them in the soil, they're not likely to come up. Now, the other option is if you spot spray the individual dandelion plants with a liquid herbicide, then you don't spray the clover.
Right.
And so it's a matter of placement, not herbicide selection. You select a broadleaf herbicide that will kill both clover and dandelion, but you only spray the dandelions.
Yeah, and that's a good way to do it. And thank you very much for calling. John Steyer, our guest, UW Extension horticulturist, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, sedges are considered among the world's most diverse and ecologically important plant families. And here in Wisconsin, we have, I believe, right around 200 species of sedges. And I tell you what, that's why it's going to be fun to talk to Andrew Hipp, who is a plant systematist and herbarium curator at the Morton Arboretum in Lyle, Illinois. He's written several books, including The Field Guide to Wisconsin Sedges, an introduction to the genus Carex, and it's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Really pleased to have him with us by phone today. You may have some questions about sedges and how they might fit into your land situation, or just some other questions in general about them. I hope you do. And I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Andrew Hipp, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate having you with us today to talk with us about sedges. And I should mention, you're pretty well acquainted with Wisconsin. You've spent a lot of time here.
Yeah, and I worked as an arranger at the UW-Madison Arboretum from 1994 to 1998. And it's really there that this book got its start. So, yeah, I think of myself primarily as a Wisconsin botanist.
And why did you decide to write about our Wisconsin sedges?
My interest in sedges really got started at the UW-Madison Arboretum. I had been working up in the Apostle Islands before I started the job at the Arboretum, and I was interested in grasses up there. And by the time I got down to the Arboretum and really got my, got acquainted with what I was doing, it was not grass season but sedge season. So I started identifying sedges and quickly found that while we had at that time a sort of hit list of four species that we were looking for seed to collect and propagate for oak savanna and prairie restorations, I was seeing maybe 20 or 30 different things out there, and I didn't know the names of them. So I just started, I got interested in it because I was interested in helping out with ecological restoration. And that's really where the project got started. And then the book project really evolved sort of gradually. Initially, it was thought of as a pamphlet that would be put out by the UW-Madison Arboretum just on their own sedges. And then my wife and I were working together on a field guide for the UW-Madison Arboretum, and Rachel started doing these drawings of the sedges.
Beautiful drawings.
And they're absolutely stunning. And then from there, the project really took off. And I think it's really the drawings that make this book what it is, that allows it to cross over from the field guide that provides you a little bit of information to the technical manual, which almost provides you too much information if you're just getting started.
Well, you know, in case somebody is just getting started, maybe you should explain, what is a sedge?
Yeah, absolutely. So sedges are grass-like plants. When you look at them superficially, they're going to look a lot like grasses. They've got narrow leaves. They've got little greenish-brownish inflorescences that seem nondescript at first. So when you begin to look at them, and if you flip through the pictures in this book, you quickly see that the genus Carex, which is the largest genus in the sedge family, is phenomenally diverse. But then when you've got a grass-like plant and you want to know if it's a sedge or a grass or a rush, there's a few characteristics that you can use to distinguish those. Sedges have leaves that are in three ranks, which means that if you look down on the plant from the top, it looks like the leaves come off of the vertices of a triangle. So they're coming off in 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, whereas grasses are two-ranked. Then the flowers, each little flower in a sedge inflorescence has a single scale underneath it, whereas grasses have got several scales, two scales underneath each flower, and then it's other scales underneath the spikelets. And then a third really good character is that if you're looking at the leaf sheath, this is the part where the leaf blade comes down, sort of wraps around the stem. The leaf sheath on sedges is closed, like a crew neck T-shirt, whereas in most grasses, all but a few genera, the margins of the leaf sheath are overlapping like a robe or a smoking jacket. So these are characteristics that quickly identify the two groups.
And, you know, as they're becoming particularly quite a bit more popular with landscapers and home gardeners.
They really are. If you look at, like, a Prairie Moon Nursery up in Minnesota is a commonly used native plant nursery throughout the upper Midwest. I think they've got like 30 species of Carex alone, and then numerous other species of the other genera. So yeah, they're really becoming quite popular.
We have callers online already to ask you some questions, but I had a question earlier. We were talking about lawns, and let's just try this out. I had a person call who lives on a lake with a flat lawn, but the lawn runs right up to the water's edge, and it's often fairly wet, the lawn itself, the grass doesn't grow very well.
Mm-hmm.
Would a sedge work in something like that?
Potentially. So where grasses excel is if you're stomping around on the lawn a lot, the grasses are going to do a lot better than the sedges. They're just hardier. However, if you've got an area that's like this that grades into a wetland or grades into a lake, and there's not a lot of foot traffic on it, I would absolutely plant that with a mix of sedges, and it would look beautiful, and it would be relatively maintenance free.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Roland in Eau Claire has a question for you, so let's go to Roland. Hi, Roland. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, I was going to mention that I'm becoming a lot more interested in nature. I served trip up as a civilian contractor with the Air Force up in northwest Greenland, 640 miles north of the Arctic Circle. We had no trees, no bushes, and I'd come back after 8 weeks of no sun and no trees and bushes, and when I'd come home on my one-month break every third month, I'd just be fascinated by trees, bushes, grass. It really caught my attention, and I got to thinking that this is what happens when we're around something all the time. We don't even stop to think about it. And I've started getting interested in some educational math games, and I'm going to start putting information on the cards so the kids learn something other than math as they're playing the games. And I was thinking that maybe I could take a book such as the one you're talking about, and then work with the author and get permission to put some facts from that into the game, so as the kids are playing math, they're also picking up some other information. And I was wondering what your guest thought about that, and also what kind of programs are in effect to try to help adults and young people become more nature conscious.
That's a great set of questions. First, as far as programs go, it seems like there's an awful lot of and a growing interest in people doing native landscaping and also just in general natural history studies. So there are a lot of informal programs out there through arboreta, through botanical gardens and nature centers. But this idea about doing a set of flashcards for students that would engage them in mathematically, but also engage them in terms of natural history or some other aspect of the world, I've never seen anything like that done. And I bet that if you were to contact, you know, people who have done a few different nature guides, and you could either do these thematically or do a mix in one pack, I bet you could put together something that would be really nice.
Yeah, I think so, too. Good luck with that, Roland. It sounds like a great idea. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We're talking today with Andrew Hipp. Andrew is the herbarium curator at the Morton Arboretum in Lisle, Illinois, and he's written the book, The Field Guide to Wisconsin Sedges, an introduction to the genus Carex, along with some just absolutely beautiful illustrations of these sedges. And it's just, they're absolutely stunning. And pleased to have him along today. And certainly, again, if you have some questions about how you might use them or in your yard or just about them in general, give us a call. And we'll be glad to put you on the air. These are mostly abundant in wetlands then, correct?
That's true. Now, so Carex is ecologically rather diverse. You do find species that do great in sand savannas, like Carex cicada, Carex muhlenbergii. You'll find growing right underneath black oaks in almost pure sand. But the majority of the species are found in wetlands. If you were to sort of break up prairies and say, okay, I'm interested in finding some species that would be useful in a typical mesic prairie, like most of our yards would be, there aren't going to be a whole lot of Carex species that'll fit in there. But there are some. But then if you look at a wet prairie, you pick up probably 10 or so more species that would do very well. Species that range from fens into wet prairies. So, yeah, they are predominantly wetland plants. And in wetlands, they're ecologically very important. They help structure sedge meadows and fens and wet prairies and bottomland forests as well.
Well, your book contains distribution maps for all the species, and it's kind of interesting how they're spread across the state.
Yeah, those distribution maps are outstanding. Those are the work of Ted Cochran, who's the herbarium curator at UW-Madison, and Merrill Black, who developed the database for the herbarium and now works up at UW-Stevens Point. And what they did is Ted has spent decades, literally decades, combing through herbarium specimens, verifying every identification, and putting a dot on the map. And so this represents thousands and thousands of specimens and countless hours of Ted's time putting dots on the map. Then when Merrill came into the project and was databasing collections from the Wisconsin collections, they were able to add some newer things. But these maps are truly unique in that Ted went to numbers of herbaria that may not be represented in any other single database. Yeah, they're extremely good maps, and they're very useful.
They certainly are. Well, of the Carex, talk a little bit about the various types. I know, for example, there's a peach fuzz wood sedge.
Right. So if you look at it would be hard to come up with a natural classification of different sedges. But I can talk about some types. There's a group like the peach fuzz sedges that you're talking about. They're a group of sedges, some of which are related, some of which are not, that have finely and densely pubescent or hairy perigenia. Now, let me tell you what the perigenium is, because I'll probably keep on mentioning it if I don't watch out. The perigenium is a sac that surrounds the female flower. So when you look at most sedges other than Carex, what you're looking at when you look at the fruit is just a little nutlet. It's an achene. A hard little thing is that if you bit it between your teeth, it would just feel like a tough little nutlet. In Carex, what you're looking at that looks like a fruit is actually a leaf-like structure that has closed up in phylogenetic time, and it's enclosing the achene inside.
Hmm.
Well, the perigenium in a group of sedges that includes Pennsylvania sedge, that includes Carex pallida, which is a lovely wet prairie sedge, that includes Carex lazia carpa, which is a marsh or bog sedge. These have got densely and finely hairy perigenia, so that you can hardly even see the surface of the perigenium.
Ron in Newburgh has a question or comment. Ron, hello to you.
Yes, good morning or good afternoon. There's a little rhyme, something about sedges have edges where grasses are something and rushes are round. Is it true that all sedges have sort of a triangular cross-section so you feel the edges on them?
And it is true that if you find a grass-like plant that is triangular in cross-section, that it's a sedge, that it's likely to be a sedge. Most Carex species are triangular in cross-section. And again, it's because I was mentioning earlier that the leaves are three-ranked. What's happening is that you're seeing the keel of the leaf sheath. These leaf sheaths are all wrapped around each other like a set of nesting dolls, and those make the edges of the triangular stem. However, there are many sedges that are not triangular in cross-section, especially once you get outside of Carex, and even some Carices. But in one genus, the spike rushes, Eleocris, you get stems that may be flat, round, four-angled, or even five-angled in cross-section.
Interesting.
So you do get variation. So right. So if it's not true always that sedges have edges.
How about in a natural woods, you know, like North Kettle Moraine or something like that, or the big forests up north, are the majority of grass-like plants that one would see walking through the woods, are the majority going to be sedges?
In the understory of the forest, the majority of the species that you would see will probably be sedges, yes. And you can, I think, again, the characteristic to use to pick these out, to make sure that you're looking at a sedge, is look at that leaf sheath. Ask yourself, is this leaf sheath closed in front, or are the margins overlapping like a robe? And that'll tell you. And in fact, the diversity of sedges in woodland understories is a very important component of the whole plant diversity of those woodlands.
Hmm, interesting.
Thank you. That was my understanding.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. And let's go to Mark in Green Bay next. Mark, hello.
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Sure.
I've got Carex cristata and Carex stipata that moved into the front of our we've got a rock wall in front of our place. I live on the bay, and mudflats were exposed about 8-10 years ago. They colonized it really quickly, but then Phragmites moved into it fairly fast after that. And I'm wondering, can the Carex hang in underneath Phragmites cover, or is that too deep a shade for them?
I don't think that they're likely to compete well against Phragmites. When I've seen high-quality sedge meadows can get overrun by Phragmites pretty badly, so I don't see them competing well. They might subsist for a time right underneath the shade. Stipeta is a real tramp. It'll exist in suboptimal conditions. It just doesn't really care all that much. But I think eventually it'll be outcompeted. Carex cristatella is a little bit, I think of as being a little bit fussier, but it's got, Carex cristatella may be able to fight back because I've seen some populations of cristatella where the late season shoots fall down on the ground and they can actually reproduce vegetatively by sending up shoots from the nodes. So I don't think it's ever going to be as good a competitor, but it might be able to move around a little bit differently.
Yes. So if I went out there and used the scythe and took down the Phragmites to like 3-4 feet up, so I wasn't taking the seed heads off of the Carex, they might encourage them, huh?
It might encourage them, but I think it would always require ongoing management.
Okay, thanks
That's
for
my
help.
Guess.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, and our old friend Adrian Whiteven is up next. Adrian, hello.
Hello. Yes, my wife and I, sorry, I've got a barking dog right now. Let me get her out of the door here. My wife and I have a native plant landscaping business, and we do try to use sedges in plantings. And I was wondering, we use a lot of Pennsylvania sedge and wonder what some of the other upland sedges would be that would be good in dry upland situations. And the second question I would also have is, are you planning any workshops or training sessions in northern Wisconsin? I'd love to take a class with you.
Well, thanks. That would be a lot of fun. I don't have any training sessions in northern Wisconsin planned, but I'd certainly be willing to talk about the possibility. As far as sedges for upland. So what kind of forest is it like? What are the dominant
trees? This is maple forest, aspen forest, northern Wisconsin, pine forest areas.
Yeah. Oh, so let me think of some species that would do well. One thing that comes to mind is Carex communis, which is a relative of Carex pennsylvanica.
Hmm.
Carex intumescens. Carex intumescens is a nice one because it's one of the bladder sedges. It's got these great, big, beautiful teardrop-shaped peregrinia, and it's actually illustrated. There's a beautiful illustration of it in the book. And it does very well in a range of shady, mesic to wet mesic forests in the north. Depending on what the forest was like, you could potentially do Carex plantaginea, which is a really showy thing. It's got big, broad leaves that are dark green.
Run into that, yeah.
It's a real lovely thing. So those are just some ideas. If you wanted a larger list, you could email me and we could talk about it.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
No problem.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Adrian. And how tall typically do those Carex sedges get?
They really vary widely. I mean, there's one in the prairies, in like dry lime prairies, Carex umbellata. People may have learned it as Carex abdita, which means hidden fruits. And it's so named because the fruiting stalks, the fruiting stems, are very, very short, typically, so that you find the peregrinia buried among the leaf bases. And you can almost miss this thing. It'll be about as high as your ankles. And then other species will be a meter or a meter and a half tall. And if you get out west, there's some, and to the old world, there's some really, really great big sedges. Now, the biggest sedge in our flora probably is not a Carex at all. It's what used to be Scirpus fluviatilis. And I believe it's called river bulrush. It's got stems that are sharply triangular, maybe 3/4 of an inch across, and the thing is husky and huge and forms great big colonies.
Well, this book that you have, the as you said earlier, the illustrations in here are really something to see, and of course a lot of very good detailed information, and something that I think any of us could learn from. Who is your intended audience?
Well, I thought of this as being a book primarily for ecologists, naturalists, home landscapers, native landscapers, wildflower enthusiasts, people who know a lot of plants and know a lot about plants and realize that they want to know sedges but don't have the time and the wherewithal to dive into the technical guides. So I thought of that as the primary audience. But the secondary audience was the professional botanist like myself coming into a new area and saying, man, I'd like to know what sedges are growing here. And I've been using the keys in this book a little bit this year, and I'm finding them helpful to jog my memory. So that's the secondary. I guess the secondary audience is myself.
Well, Andrew, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Appreciate it very much. Andrew Hipp is the herbarium curator at the Morton Arboretum in Lisle, Illinois. But he's spent a lot of time in Wisconsin and has written, and his wife illustrated, Field Guide to Wisconsin Sedges, and it's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Pleased to have him with us. And thank you for listening. Monday, we'll talk Alzheimer's disease with Dr. Mark Sager. And then we'll talk pairing wine with cheese. Couple of guests for you there. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.